Welcome to the Food and Faith Podcast, conversations from the soil and around the table with your co-hosts Anna Wolfenden and Sam Chamlin.
I'm so thrilled to have our guest Kendall Vanderslice on the show today. Kendall is somebody who I've loved being in conversations about food and faith with for a number of years now. And she's one of my number one go-tos when I have a question about looking deeper at the way that food interacts with culture, with land, with faith. And her expertise is something that we are really grateful to have. We're looking forward to hearing what she's up to and have her share some of her wisdom with us today.
Thank you so much, Kendall. Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So we like to start off by asking our guests what their geography is. What is the land, the food, the culture that you come from?
So I am somewhat of a nomad. I have lived in many places. I was born in Texas. I went to high school and college in the Midwest. And then I moved up to New England for a while. And I'm now living in the South, in Durham, North Carolina. And I feel like each individual place has shaped me, but also this movement of being from several places has shaped me. Lots of questions of how do flavors and tastes of place interact with one another and form kind of the sum of who we are. So I don't really have one distinct place that I call home. When people ask, I normally name all of the places and say I'm currently in Durham.
Resonate with that.
Yeah, people like to ask that question a lot. Where are you from? And it's a hard one to answer. I don't have a place that I'm from. Yeah. I'm formed by all the places, and they've all been home at various points. And sometimes family lives in some of those places, and sometimes they don't.
Great. So. I often allude to the children of Israel wandering in the wilderness. I'm camped here right now.
Yep, but that wandering forms you too. That wandering really does, I think, influence your relationship to place.
And how has food come into that? Is there a food that has followed you? Is there a food that means home? Or have you collected food from different places?
I mean, I think bread is the kind of my core piece of, yeah, bread is everything for me. But that looks different in different places. You know, I've whether it's making sourdough bread or making biscuits or making, you know, my grandfather's pancakes, and somehow bread of some kind seems to be the thread that carries me through each place.
Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
My love of bread.
Yeah, your love of bread.
Man, I don't know. It has sort of, the love of baking has always been there. And I think the bread has always been sort of this ongoing theme as well. I remember taking a field trip to Great Harvest Bread Company when I was in second grade. And we watched the bakers and saw kind of the whole industrial process of, this was kind of right on the cusp of this artisan bread movement as people were starting to really value homemade bread again, or smaller scale bread again. It's been a love of mine ever since. I kind of, from that moment, wanted to be in the kitchen and wanted to have my hands in dough. And it's like it's like this full bodied thing. You feel it in your whole body. The feel of flour on your hand.
This is where one of those times the podcast doesn't do it justice. Like, you have to see the video. Like, I wish folks could see, like, watch your face as you talk about bread. I don't know that I've ever had a conversation with you that didn't involve bread at some point. Like, it's just a part of you. And so one of the things I think is cool about the movement, and you've experienced this, we've experienced this, is that there are always these overlapping interests that kind of collide with, for lack of a better term, theological inquiry. And your love of bread has been kind of that intersection for you. Where did that intersection happen? Where did that aha moment of, this bread is teaching me something about the Creator and my relationship with God? Like, What was that for you?
Yeah, it happened when I watched Peter Reinhardt's TED Talk. That it's like the story of bread or something. I can't remember the exact name of it, but if you just Google Peter Reinhardt TED Talk, you'll find it.
We'll see if we can find that.
Yeah.
Post it somewhere.
It's a wonderful one. I'm currently in the process of like building up the courage to email him because I want to bake with him for my thesis research. Mm. And he's like,
so if you're listening, Peter.
Send an email for me. He lives in Charlotte. I'm a little bit of a creep and I know that he only lives 3 hours from me. Okay. But yeah, so I saw that TED Talk the summer after I graduated from undergrad. And at that point, I had begun asking these questions about food and theology and how they intersected with one another. I was already kind of wholly interested and embedded in the anthropology of food and academic study of food. And as I was digging into this academic study of food, the role of food throughout scripture just became increasingly, I couldn't read anything without seeing it. And couldn't read the story of Genesis without seeing the role of food, and couldn't understand, you know, just all these connections started making sense. And so I was already kind of in this mindset of like, there's something important to food. There's something powerful in the way that God uses food throughout this narrative arc of the gospel. And I saw that as culminating in the Eucharist. But I had a love for bread and baking, but I didn't see that distinct connection between the use of bread and the Eucharist. And then when I heard this TED Talk from Peter Reinhardt, he talked through the 10 steps of bread. So there's 10 basic steps in the process of baking bread that kind of, any baker that talks about bread talks about like the 10 steps. Anyway, so he uses these 10 steps and he carries us through these 10 steps. And throughout the process, he's basically giving the story of death and resurrection and death and resurrection. And there's nothing explicitly religious to this TED Talk, but by the end of it, it's just like he's preaching the gospel right here of what it means for something to die and rise again for the sake of feeding the world and bringing the world back to life. And that was this huge aha moment. And then I Googled a little bit more about him because he's written all these bread books. And I was like, is this guy religious? Because clearly he's speaking religious language here. And found out that he has just a fascinating story. He is Eastern Orthodox, and bread and his formation, Christian formation, were really intertwined with one another in fascinating ways. And so I've been a little bit obsessed ever since. And so, Peter, if you're listening to this, respond to my email.
We'll try to tag him.
Yeah.
So what do you think it is? I mean, that bread specifically, what do you think it is about food that makes it such a good place to enter into these wider conversations? Like, what is it about food that captures you?
I think food is kind of the center point of everything. Food is, we were created to eat. We have to eat. Everything has to eat. Every living thing eats something somehow, whether it's soaking in nutrients through your roots or whether it's, you know, soaking in energy from the sun. Still, every living thing is somehow taking food, transforming it into energy that keeps them going. But as humans, we were created with tongues and taste buds and this need not only to eat, but this ability to enjoy the process of eating. And that's the opening story. Like, that's how scripture opens, is here's all this food, here's all these living things. Now live in the garden and eat. And yeah, I just find that really beautiful. But the fact that it just points to this God's desire for delight, that God created us to delight in us, but God also created us to delight in this world around us. And somehow that happens through the process of eating. But then also food becomes this center point of destruction as well, that the story of Genesis 3 is the story of eating food outside of the context that God asks us to eat food in, somehow eating food for one's own desire rather than for this corporate delight. And see those resonances now throughout all of history, that food is both this point of delight and also this point of deep pain. And that's where I see just that food is so powerful, that there's something about food that is so powerful. And we see that in the ways that it has been the center of delight and the center of pain throughout all of history. Why God chose food, I don't know, but I'm really glad God did. yeah, I think there's something about the fact that it is something outside of us that we incorporate into our very being, and it becomes a part of us. But it's also this continual reminder of our ultimate reliance on God and the way that God has created the world to function, that we can't make food appear on our own. We might feel like we can right now because we can go to the grocery store, but like no food just appears. It has to grow. It requires tending of the soil. It requires rain. It requires the sun. And all of those things require the world to function in the way that God created it to function. And then, it's this ongoing reminder that we are deeply interconnected with everything around us, and also that we are deeply reliant on something outside, completely outside of ourselves and outside of creation.
You know, I just haven't read your article the last few weeks that you wrote, Power in the Plate. And I was really struck by how you took both that interconnection that you just talked about creation, but then also looking at what are the power dynamics that happen within our food. You said, while our foodways taste of the magnificent of a creative God, they also bear the scars of people and cultures harmed through power wielded cruelly along the way. And around the table, laden with the complicated stories each flavor tells, we're invited to participate in the reconciliation of all things. And I was just really struck by both those sentences, but your article as a whole, in terms of tracing both the beauty and the scars. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how your work has brought you to the human interaction in that interconnected web, and where you do see those power dynamics played out.
So most recently, I've really been focused on the last 500-ish years, and really looking at the way food has been this driving force in social change in negative and positive ways in the last 500 years. And I've really been focused a lot on spice trade and the connection with colonialism and stimulants, coffee, tea, sugar, chocolate, and kind of their connection to slavery and how those things have all led us to today. And I think that's kind of a really good paradigm to see this spread of culture and power being wielded in harmful ways. That it's like Western desire for spices was a desire for something good, a desire for tastes that were good. And there was this deeper theological layer to it of these flavors come from the East, this like paradise that is assumed to be in the East, which mapped onto these theological understandings of the sun rises in the East, and that that Christ comes from the East, and that this paradise that we're looking towards is the East. And so there was this deep desire and excitement over the flavors of spices and the ways that it sang of the magnificence of God. And yet that desire and that taste turned into something that became, it became the flavors of the elite in the West, and it became this form through which tables became stratified by class, that you were wealthy if you could afford these flavors, if you were wealthy, you could afford these flavors. And if you were not, your food was much plainer, and there's this increasing stratification that happened at the table. Yeah, so it was this good desire for taste that ultimately led to extensive destruction. And it was because of those who had power and those who did not, who were powerless in the present situation. And food and the role of food became paradigmatic in that those who had power, their hunger allowed them to obliterate or completely shift the food ways of those who did not have power. And so this desire for flavors that were mapped on with these theological interests led to this colonization of the Americas. And with that came this attempt to convert and bring theology and bring Christianity in a way that was deeply tied up and wound up with these with taste and with power and with using taste or using power to shift taste, and a way that was grounded, that was really exemplified in the time was through communion and Eucharist and the difference between wheat and corn, and that it was established then that communion, that the bread used for communion had to be wheat, and wheat wasn't grown in the Americas. Corn was the staple grain of the Americas. And it became this way of wielding power over the people who were here by changing their food ways to try and make them eat wheat, to try and make them European, to try and make them Christian, in this way that was really wound up and harmful. And I think we see echoes of that, or maybe even ramifications of that today, and still the role of corn in the relationship between especially like white consumers in the United States and our Mexican brothers and sisters just down south, who are having their own economic structures, and that has been deeply reliant on corn and various types of corn for generations and generations and generations. And through this desire for cheap corn in the United States, we've again used our power structures in ways that have ruined farmers economically. But it's just this ongoing cycle of this relationship between those who have power privileging the flavors that they want and controlling the flavors that they think other people should have or eat. That maybe is too theoretical.
No, I don't think so at all.
Okay.
No. And you've just did an excellent job of drawing straight lines. And something Anna and I have been advocating for, I think, through this podcast, is that food is never just food. It is, it's sociology, it's politics, it's economics, it's theology and all of that. And just the illustration of wheat and corn, like it never would have occurred to me to think about what indeed that bread is even made of that I eat when I come to the Eucharistic table and what is wrapped up in that. And so just that point alone is enough, is certainly worth the price of the podcast. No doubt about it. So now one of the things I think, another question we've been asking is that, and you've made it so clear that food takes us to all these other places, and requires us to have all these conversations. And you're one of the greatest advocates that I know, at least in the spaces that we occupy, for advocating for food and faith, and why the church needs to be asking questions about food production and who gets to eat that food and all that kind of stuff. Do you find yourself, when you interact with faith communities, having a hard time making this argument? Like, do faith communities want to leave food as something sort of outside the purview of all this? Or do you find that faith communities are pretty receptive to having food, agriculture, land, all those kind of things that are tied up in this? Like, they're ready to have that conversation with you.
Generally, I think people are pretty excited. People like to talk about food. But what I found is that my research has kind of begun in the cultural studies of food and has begun in studying the process of eating together and what happens when we eat together and why do we choose to eat what we choose to eat. And those are conversations people are excited to have and fascinated to have, and they find really interesting because people like to eat. I do think the conversations around the broader food system and food equity, food access, food justice, food apartheid, and ways that we can better engage with our relationship with the land, those are harder to have. Because on one sense, people feel paralyzed. They know there's something wrong with the food system and somehow my choices are implicated in that. But I've heard a variety of different and conflicting ideas about what's best for my health, what's best for the environment, what's best economically. And also facing really very, very real limitations financially in what they're capable of buying or geographically in who they're able to buy from. And so I think that I see both an eagerness to talk about food and a fascination with the connection between food and faith. And then pretty quickly after that, a paralysis of what does this mean for how I choose to eat? And do I really have to think that hard about it? So I think that there's something important to kind of to note in that the people are that people are eager to have the conversations about food, and that we need to start in this eating together. What happens when we eat together, and what foods do you connect with? That has to be the starting point, I think, in order to inch away at this paralysis and these bigger system questions.
So how do you see that showing up in church work? I know we haven't spoken about this yet on the podcast, but your area of research is dinner churches, or your current project, your published book that's coming out that we're very excited about in May. And we'll talk about that more on the podcast when it gets closer. But how do you see that envelope being pushed? How do you see that transition from cool food and it being, you know, a trendy conversation to be able to move into some of these bigger questions of equality and justice economics?
Yeah. So for most of the churches that I visited, so I wrote a book about dinner churches. It involved traveling the country to visit churches that hold their services around the table, around a meal. I looked at churches from a variety of denominations and a variety of contexts, urban, suburban, rural, a variety of sizes, really small to really large. Really large was like 200 people. So different definition of small and large than your average church.
Yeah. But in the general church world, that's large.
Yeah, very large. And what I found for most of them was that holding church around a dinner table was not what they did because it was cool. It was what they did because almost out of necessity. For most of the communities that I was a part of, they weren't really a part of these like foodie conversations. They wouldn't have called themselves foodie. Some of them maybe would cringe at the word foodie. But for the most part, they're communities that are hungry. Yeah. Hungry quite physically for food, hungry for community, hungry for some sort of spiritual experience, some sort of encounter with God that is separate from kind of the politics of the church world that they had maybe been hurt by or felt rejected from. And so both within those churches, I see these conversations about the importance of food happening because there's no question or doubt to them that food is vital. And also I see that as a helpful kind of next step in talking about food with broader communities of great. You get excited about the intersection of food and faith. Great. You get excited about talking about what you ate for dinner last night and posting it on Instagram because you went to a cool restaurant and that's great. And now let's talk about these churches. And they also become a helpful starting point of like, let's question like, why are there people in our churches who are hungry? What is the church able to do to address these needs of those who are hungry? And what happens when we eat together and address these needs as a church community? And what happens when we ask why those needs exist in the first place? I think it begs really important questions for the church as to what is our call and responsibility in addressing hunger, because food insecurity is far more real than and a far more pressing issue in most of our churches than we realize. I think most people don't realize that there's a large swath of people in their church, wherever your church is, who might not know where their meal is coming from tomorrow, or who might not know if they can eat a meal every day this week. And they might not be the people you would look at and think, they're on the edge of poverty. But these are people who are in our communities, and we're not seeing them, and we're not engaging these conversations. And so I think that actually getting around the table and worshiping together around the table is where these kind of economic realities come to light, and where we address these needs in places that also allow for the vulnerability that makes these needs known. I think that at some of these inner churches also, they help to challenge the questions around ethical food or good food what kinds of food we should serve. At one particular church that I went to in Chattanooga, they served pizza most nights. That was their kind of dinner church meal. And for most of the people that came, that was the one meal that they really enjoyed all week. And they would comment on how they came here because in the serving of pizza, they felt seen and they felt known and they felt loved, because this wasn't a church saying, here's what we identify that you need, or saying, here's what you need to be healthy, or here's what, if you're going to eat our food, you have to come worship with us and you have to eat what we serve you. It was this realization of, you have so few moments in your life where you get to really taste and enjoy the process of eating and the process of eating with other people. And so we're going to serve you this thing that is really precious to you. And so, no, the pizza doesn't fit within these, where does pizza fit in these conversations around sustainable agriculture and good food? And, it might not make it into those conversations, but to serve anything else, I think, would be failing to really see the needs of this community and how those needs can be met in food, and how that present need, when all of your life is this insecurity and I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight and I don't know where I'm going to eat tomorrow, just the taste of pizza can be that point of being Christ to someone else.
Yeah.
Huh. That's such an important point. I mean, that's something I saw so often, and I think people have opinions. I think, it's what are we placing value on? And it's all connected, and there are true values in these different things. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how a lot of people would approach me at the Garden Church and be like, of course your meal is vegan, right? And it was like, no, it's sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It's not that we don't value some of those environmental principles. It's not, but like also pizza was really great. So it is, and it's like the complexity is important, and to be able to like dig into, yes, we will have competing values. That is the reality, is that there mm-hmm. are competing values, and how do we have an awareness of those? How do we work with those together? Seems so much more helpful in the long run than just picking one set and being mm-hmm. like fundamentalist mm-hmm. about it. It's like, no, this is actually connected.
And I think this is again where this question of power pops back up, of like looking historically, especially looking at the role of colonization and European presence in the Americas. There was this sort of narrative brought in that sort of like that this wisdom existed that is the best way to grow and the best way to produce and the best way to eat. And Western Europeans really shifted the landscape of the Americas because they narrated this set of values of how we should relate to the land and how we should relate to our bodies and how we should eat and what we should eat. And it was out of their ideas of health and their idea that they were doing what was healthy and what was best. And clearly now we see the repercussions of that, that it was highly destructive, that their ideas of health were not healthy, that their relationship with the land were really problematic, that and it is this again, this power at play that in some ways was an attempt to exert power, and in some ways was misguided knowledge behind their values. And we really have to question again, like, how are we doing that now? Who's narrating these values? And maybe their intentions really are good, but how are they also sort of exhibiting that power in this attempt to narrate values right. and to control this narrative of how do we relate to the land? How do we relate to our bodies? How do we relate to what we eat?
Yeah. And I can't help but stop and go back to something you said earlier about God's desire for delight. And how so often, yeah, these rules mm-hmm. impose things that just aren't delightful for us. But the God yeah. that you're speaking about, you know, invites us into a place of delight and enjoyment. And mm-hmm. so, and that's written all over your face. I mean, as I get to watch you via Zoom, I mean, just the delight that comes. So we're at the end of our time together, but we didn't want to let you get away without asking. Hey, we got after it. So wanted to end with a question, as we always do. What brings you hope? And not the kind of hope that pushes aside the problems, but the hope that gets you up in the morning.
So you'll probably not be surprised that I'm going to say that bread is the thing that really brings me hope.
No way.
I know, right?
Three guesses. Bread.
A little bread. Bit. but really, I think more than anything, posted a really cheesy Instagram about this last night, but really I think sourdough starter is something that really brings me hope. Because I just started a new one on Saturday, and it's remarkable to me every time that I can mix together flour that when you buy it in a bag looks like it's dead and dry and lifeless, and then I can mix it with water and just set it on my counter for 3 days and it bubbles back to life, and that this thing that I can keep feeding, and it's just going to grow and it's going to become more nuanced in its character and in its flavor and in its smell and in its bacterial profile. It's just this very small and very tangible reminder that like there is life just waiting to spring forth all around us. And so there are these the miraculous is taking place all around us in ways that we can't see it or expect. It really gives me hope, and as this constant reminder that God's engagement with the world is so much bigger and grander and more mysterious than I can fathom. And that there are little things that I can control, like I can mix the flour and the water together, but there's so much more that happens to bring the world to life that I'm not the one who drives that. And when I see the process take place in bread, and when I'm reminded, when I feed on Christ through bread, I'm reminded of my own just smallness in the world and the depth of what God is doing.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, how can people connect with you and with examples like that through your writing and speaking? And can people continue to have your voice as part of their conversation?
Yeah, you can connect with me on Twitter and on Instagram at KBLice, like Kendall Vander Slice. And you can visit my website. It's kendallvanderslice.com. I have links there to all of my writing and most of my podcast interviews and such. And so that's the best way to find the various things I've written. But most importantly, come May 15th, 2019, you can buy my book. Woo-hoo! We Will Feast, Rethinking Dinner, Worship, and the Community of God, coming out in May with Erdman's Press.
Fabulous. And also, you have a wonderful newsletter, your Edible Theology newsletter, which I really enjoy reading each month.
Yeah, it goes me every month, but yeah. I'm in school right now, so sometimes some months get skipped.
Whenever it comes out, I enjoy it. So how can people sign up for that?
Yes, that is on Tiny Letter. So it's tinyletter.com/edible-theology.
Awesome. And we'll put all those in the show notes as well. So we hope that our listeners follow you, and we'll look forward to having you on our show again come May when your book comes out.
Yay, I'm so excited. Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a gift to talk to you guys.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Food and Faith Podcast. Our collaborators are Wake Forest University School of Divinity, Plainsong Farm, Garden Church, and the Keep and Till. And the music is by Paul Diemer. Follow along and keep up to date with the podcast on Facebook at Food and Faith Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at Food and Faith Pod, or on our website at foodandfaithpodcast.org.